Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready, and they call the South Hudson Bell Telephone Company versus Delaney. 25 minutes for general audit, 3 minutes for oral argument, with 10 minutes for rebuttal. And the court is ready to hear oral argument from the petitioner.
May it please the court. Your Honor, Mr. Richard Bio, Houston, will present argument for petitioner.
May it please the court. My name is Richard Bio, and I am the attorney for the petitioner in this case, Southwestern Bell Telephone Company. I'd like to start at the outset to thank you for giving me the opportunity to discuss the case. It's particularly troublesome to our company and its business, the Yellow Pages advertising business. Of course, I was sitting through the last argument. And I noticed one factor that I don't think is present in our court, and that is that in that FDP case, and on the issues of warranty, on the issues of the Texas Deceptive Trade Practices Act, we're on some fairly uncharted waters, and I think the court is grappling, as everybody is, to try and determine where the standard is, where the breaking point is when a matter is to be treated as merely a provision of a contract versus a warranty. Would submit that we don't have that problem in this case, that we don't have uncharted waters here, and that we have a fairly clear straightforward issue, that being simply the question of whether or not where you have a breach of contract situation or where you have parties dealing through a contract, whether the cause of action properly sounds in contract, thus applying all of the terms of the contract, or whether it's a tort. This case is not a great deal different than the FDP case, or most cases dealing with breach of Yellow Page advertising cases. Southwestern Bell publishes a book in various cities throughout the state once a year. The directory salesmen go out in a group throughout the state once a year, and they canvass and go to all of their customers and find out what advertising they want, if they want any changes and so forth, and they sign a contract. As you know, the contract limits the liability to the return of any money that they've paid for the advertising.
The claim is that limitation of liability that has caused Southwestern Bell to be sloppy, and there's no inducement for them to do better.
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that's the case. We've litigated many of these cases, and I don't know one case. And I've heard in some cases presented the evidence, and I have never seen anybody even contend that Southwestern Bell's Yellow Pages operation is shoddy. It certainly is not. But that is not an issue in this case, and as far as I know, it's not an issue in any case. So I don't think it's a question here of inducing better business. Southwestern Bell does not make money if it leaves ads out. Ads obviously is a big part of their earnings, and therefore it's in their interest to have as clean an operation as they can. Now, it's not a perfect operation. There are human errors, and to create an operation that would be error-free, I really doubt that anybody could afford advertising out of that situation. But at any rate, I think the point to be made is that Yellow Pages operation is an efficient, well-run operation, and that the inducement to get the money for the ads that they have contracted for is inducement enough. And they're constantly updating their operation with computers and things of that sort. At any rate,
can there be an action for negligence in the performance of a contractual obligation?
Your Honor, there cannot be under the law.
Schoenbeck is just wrong.
Your Honor, I don't think Schoenbeck is wrong. And it's my position that you can look at the International Pressing case, you can look at the, which is a 1946 case, you can look at the Schoenbeck case, and then when you finally throw in Jim Walters Holmes, the rule is very clear And let me tell you why I think that. Schierenbach, when it's cited by other courts, is typically, the cite is typically limited to what says, in effect, that out of every contract arises a duty in part, or contract. If you read two sentences before that and two sentences after, you see there's really a different twist to that. What the case really holds is that out of every contract, there is a relationship that is created. And it's not unlike the relationship that is created or exists in normal negligence cases. You have two cars that are 200 miles apart coming to each other. There's a slight relationship. As they get closer and closer and closer, the relationship becomes greater. But when they meet, now a relationship is there. And that relationship creates a duty to exercise reasonable care. What Schierenbach is saying is that a contract can bring the parties, in somewhat the same way, can bring those parties together. And once they're brought together, then a relationship is created, and that relationship creates a duty at law. And that duty at law is not to injure that other person, not to do personal injury to that other person or property damage. And I think that follows on into Jim Walker Holmes, which holds essentially the same thing.
Why should we enshrine a rule that gives greater protection for property damage, I mean, which could be very minor, than it would to damage to business reputation, damage here to goodwill, which could be very great?
Well, I think the reason...
I'm just having a hard time. I can see the distinction. I think you're right. I think you can weave through these cases and come up with that. Schierenbach, the plumber, blew up the house, I believe. But doesn't it fall apart logically?
Your Honor, I believe that rules of law sometimes fall apart logically. But because the courts have to set some sort of they have to draw a line somewhere, and that there are public policy reasons for drawing those lines. Sometimes...
Well, what's the public... In Schierenbach, couldn't it be consequential damages, to the contract? We paid you $50 to come replumb our house and it blew up, creating $100,000 worth of damages. That could come under a contract theory as well as a court theory. It has limitations and longer under a contract theory.
Well, again, the distinction that's been drawn is that you have to look at what the parties contemplate. The parties, when they enter a contract, do not contemplate that they may have to pay for damages because through negligence the house blows up, or that the owner of the house is killed in the process. So, you know, property damage, in essence, is a personal injury. And I think that's why it's thrown in there, Judge, and why it's there, is that has historically been considered personal injury damage. Property damage and personal, or is considered car damage.
It's always injury to the goodwill of the business.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
It's always injury to the goodwill of the business.
Well, but injury to either the goodwill of the business or to the profits of the business is a part of the basis of the bargain. That's part of the contract. That is an essential part of the contract, and that's what the cases have held. And I think that's very logical. I think that what the courts have tried to do is say, look at the contract. What did the parties contemplate in the contract? If the parties are contemplating in the contract, as they generally are, the damages should be limited, or if the party contemplates the loss of lost profits, then I think that's a part of the bargain.
Is the expectation of the parties also a part of the bargain?
I agree, Your Honor. That's exactly right. And so, again, to determine the expectations of the parties, you have to look at the contract. And that's what the courts have done. You look at the contract, and in the case of these, of the Yellow Pages cases, the expectation of the parties are clearly stated to limit damages. So there's no
expectation. If the plumber says, I might blow up your house, and if I do, that would be $500.
It would be.
Then they expected it, and so we don't have a tort.
Your Honor, I think where the law is, where the line is drawn, is not what the parties put into the contract, but at some point, public policy takes over. And the distinction, the rule is made that if you're talking about personal injury, if you're talking about property damage, that a different rule applies, and that and that becomes a tort. Now, that is not to say that parties to a contract cannot limit their liability for tort damages, for the very damages that you indicate. However, in so doing, they face much stricter scrutiny by courts such as this one when they come to ask for those limitations to be found conscionable. The Kroll case out of Dallas is a perfect example of that, where negligence was limited on the part of residents of low-income housing for any type of damages, personal injury or otherwise. And they asked for that to be held to be enforceable. And the court said no. It violates public policy.
Well, is your answer then that former and limited damages blowing up the house? Is there a way to do it?
I think there's a way to do it. The question then becomes, are the courts going to enforce it? And the courts to enforce it are going to look to the rules of unconscionability. I guess the point here, Your Honor, is that the law of contracts provides for exactly that eventuality. And so if you've got a contract, I think the point is to use contract law.
So you would say the unconscionability standard should be applied to your contract?
And it has in the past been applied, Your Honor. Yes, sir.
And does it make a difference if Southwestern Bell touts itself as being a mere monopoly, if you're the one and only?
Let me address that.
Who doesn't get in your book is cut off from access to the public. You know.
Well, in the first place, of course, the Southwestern Bell's business is not regulated. Never has been. It's a separate corporation now, but at that time it was a department. It's never been regulated. At the same time, that business has been, and always has been, as far as I know, competitive. There's never been any rule. It's not regulated to provide a monopoly. Now, whether or not Bell has had a monopoly in one city or another, I don't know, because monopoly brings about a whole lot of different concepts, and I don't know. Suffice to say that I know of no court that has ever held that Southwestern Bell has a particular additional duty because of any monopoly status that it has.
Something like that were submitted in the case.
The only evidence in this case, Your Honor, was that Southwestern Bell and Yellow Pages in 1980 in Galveston Market, because it was the same year as the FDP case, and there was evidence in that case that there was a lot of competition in the Houston area. But in that market in Galveston, Southwestern Bell, according to our sales representative that testified, was the only book covering that market. Now, that's not to say that anybody else that wanted to come in there couldn't, but somehow or another we had a monopoly.
Is there any place in Texas in which Southwestern Bell does not have way over 50% of the market share of the business?
I really don't know, Your Honor. I don't know.
Well, as far as providing the telephone service itself, there are many areas in the state where Bell has an absolute monopoly, doesn't it?
In every area that Southwestern Bell gives telephone service, has a franchise to provide telephone service, it has, in effect, a monopoly through that franchise. Yes.
Does it thereby, and through its regulation by the Public Utility Commission, have a duty imposed by law to supply basic telephone service?
It does, Your Honor, under the PURA, the Public Utilities Regulatory Act.
Then doesn't the International Printing Pressman case that you referred to earlier, in which you cited in your brief, stand for the proposition that Bell's responsibility is a heightened one and can be answerable in tort?
Well,
because it's a public service corporation with a duty imposed by law.
Well, but the Yellow Pages, and that was my point, it's Yellow Pages business is specifically accepted under the statute, and it is not a regulated business. It has no duties by the Yellow Pages or by the Public Utilities Commission, other than the commission does require the imputation of its revenues or its earnings into the rate base, the telephone service, and to provide a subsidy to the low cost of local telephone service.
Well, I'm aware of the position of the Yellow Pages vis-a-vis the Public Utility Commission, but in this case, don't we really have complaints about two separate contracts, about one relating to the basic phone service and the transfer that occurred or didn't occur?
That's
one of the claims, and one of the claims that the dissent in the Court of Appeals addressed.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think you'll find that in the concurring opinion. where they went off on a malfeasance or misfeasance, nonfeasance theory, and suggested and brought up the fact that what caused the error, what caused the advertisement to be omitted, was when he went to get his telephone service changed over so that this particular telephone that had the billing on it, when he changed it over to be a part of a rotary system, that caused the advertising, which was billed to that other telephone number, to be deleted. Now, Southwestern Bell did not take the position in this case that was his fault. I mean, there was concession in this case that he wasn't advised of that, and that we had an obligation to do that, and that we were at fault. But that's what the court went off on, and they seem to be suggesting they used that as the basis for bypassing the misfeasance and nonfeasance rule. Because if you strictly apply the rule, that would say that if the entire contract is left out, if it's a complete failure to do what you're supposed to do, as opposed to misfeasance where you've undertaken to do it and you've done it poorly, let's say you put the wrong telephone number, if you applied the nonfeasance misfeasance rule, that we would win in that case. But he didn't, and he went off on this other theory that, well, this accident or this incident was occurring because of a separate contract. The fact is, our position would be that what you have to look at is what was he suing for? He was not suing because his telephone service was messed up. He was suing because the advertising for which he had contracted was not given. And under those circumstances, it doesn't matter what the reason is. Question is, was it done in error? If it had been done by some computer operator at Yellow Pages Production in Dallas, then I think that, and had that computer operator pressed the wrong button and so that the ad was omitted, the result would be the same. He doesn't get the advertising, and it was through error. But again, you have to look at what he's trying to enforce. In this case, he was trying to enforce or he was asking for damages for breach of that contract. And so the way the court was going there didn't make a whole lot of sense. Suffice it to say that he just ignored the non-feasant, misfeasant rule. And I don't know how else to explain it.
If there is a duty undertaken by contract and the contract is silent on what standard is to apply to the performance of that duty, how do you allege a breach when the complaint is that it was not performed properly, such as faulty performance of work on a house, faulty performance of plumbing, or the failure to place an ad as in this case?
Well, I think in a contract cause of action, the standard is, did you perform the contract? I don't think the standard is whether you did it negligently or not. I think courts tend to look at that. But the underlying issue, if the case is in contract, is whether or not there was performance under the contract. If there wasn't performance, you breached the contract.
The contract is to perform plumbing services, and some plumbing services are performed, but the recipient of the services is not satisfied with the result. How does he complain?
Well, I take it you're talking about a situation where I provide plumbing services to a house, I tell them I'm going to fix their bathtub, and I don't fix it properly.
You fix it, but it's not satisfactory to the owner and might not be satisfactory to a reasonable person.
And therefore it might not be satisfactory to the court.
What's your standard? Perfection? Okay?
Well,
non-negligent? Whatever you do, what's the standard?
I think the courts would typically look at see if he has performed that job in the way that most professionals doing that work would do.
Isn't that negligent?
It's negligent if you don't have a contract. If what he's suing for is personal injury damages, if what he's suing for is property damage.
Isn't the way most people do it under the same or similar circumstances, isn't that the negligence standard?
Your Honor, in every breach of a contract except an intentional breach, there is negligence involved. I mean, there's no denying that. I can't sit here and tell you that any contract that we have ever breached wasn't done through some error, and therefore negligence. It's always that way.
But that negligence is not actionable, you say.
We're saying that the negligence is not actionable, that if the result is a breach of the contract, that is actionable. You've got to look to the contract. And so I think that the point is that if you're suing for the failure to do what you have contracted to do, then it's, and in these cases, it's clear. I mean, it's not a question of whether you do it properly. It's a question of whether you do it all. And I think in these cases, in our cases, there's never an intentional. I have never seen that either alleged or proven. So it's always negligent. The question of whether you recover, though, is that particular activity covered by the contract? And if what you're suing for is the cost for having somebody else come in there and do it properly, that's contract damages. And so you sue a contract. You don't sue at all. And I think that the courts have been pretty uniform in that regard. And they have applied this court's ruling in Pressman, Montgomery Ward, and Jim Walker's home. And I think, based on my reading of the cases that have come down since Jim Walker's home, with the exception of the Sixth Court Appeal, I mean, we're talking about a fairly, very tight result in applying this court's directives. I don't think there's been a whole lot of confusion about it, to be quite frank. And there's been a number of cases, and I've cited them in our brief. I don't think I have to, we haven't gotten to the point of what the trial court did in this case, but I think that you probably understand that the trial court, in this case, refused issues on the DTPA. The plaintiff requested breach of warranty instructions. The court found at the close of the evidence that there was no evidence and refused that. There's been no appeal for that. Over objections, the court did instruct the jury and or submit issues on negligence. He refused any issues on punitive damages or gross negligence because he found that there was no evidence of that. And he also submitted issues on what he took to be the proper standard for inconstability, that is disparity bargaining power, and he submitted issues on that. The plaintiff intentionally refused to request any issues on breach contract. And I can only say that he was relying on the McKinnon case, which this court may be aware of, which in effect held that if you plead negligence, that's all you have to do, and you avoid the contract and any limitations in the contract. And that's what the lower court did here. On the basis of the findings of negligence by the jury, the court applied that. He refused because of the one of two things, or perhaps both, because of the Court of Appeals decision in McKinney, refused to apply the limitation, and because of that jury finding of disparity, refused to apply the limitation, and granted judgment, which came to some $252,000 with prejudgment interest and all. $109,000, the jury found $109,000 for the year in question, $40,000 for future damages. The court remitted the future damages award to $11,840. And all of this was for an ad that cost the plaintiff in this case $720 for the year.
Would your position be the same if the ad had been published but was illegible?
You're getting back into the misfeasance versus nonfeasance, I take it, Your Honor. We don't believe that that's a good test. The test has been criticized, and we would, this court, the Supreme Court, in dealing with this issue, has never used that test, and I would submit that it's just inappropriate. It's too hard to manage, and it's just not appropriate. And to answer your question, if we put the ad in wrong, if it's illegible, or if the telephone number's left out, the rest of it's there, if it's tantamount to misfeasance, then we would still say that the limitation would apply.
And the suit would be in contract.
And the suit would be in contract, absolutely, yes.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court is ready to hear arguments from the respondent.
Hey, please report. Your Honor, Mr. Anthony P. Griffin from Galveston will present argument for respondent.
If you may please, court. Mr. Delaney's case, I think, purples or should be decided on the fact that was presented before the trial court, and that is Eugene C. Delaney started a real estate business in 1978. That business grew. It grew in part to Southwestern Dell Yellow Pages and using that medium. The facts in the case reveal that Southwestern Bell was the only game in town. It also revealed that because of the ability to advertise, some 80% of the marketplace referred to their yellow pages on a yearly basis. Some 40% of those people who were looking for real estate went to the yellow pages. Mr. Delaney's business grew to the extent that from 1978 to the year that the ad was deleted, he was dominating 25% of the market. So one out of every four closings that took place in the Galveston market, he dominated and he received. After the ad, and the testimony was unrefuted, after the ad was deleted, Mr. Delaney's telephone stopped ringing. And I think that's consistent with the advertisements that we see on a daily basis, that your business phone is your business life. Mr. Delaney, in the process of trying to determine what happened, discovered that when his wife made a unrelated call for services, that they had a business known as D&D Enterprises that had become inactive, that they wanted to cancel such listing, and they wanted to take one of the lines and attach it to Gene Delaney and Associates Realtors because that was an ongoing concern, and put it on the rotating line. And unbeknownst to him, Southwestern Bell's employees said, we can do that for you, and we will do that for you. And we'll add that extra line onto the rotary line. And internally, they made a decision to build his line or build his services differently. They took his ad, they did what he contracted to do, and what he contracted with them to do, and that was to cease the advertisement and to cease D&D Enterprises and put it on a rotating line. And then they went a step further. The employee failed to notice on the microfiche that was sitting on her desk that if she did what she did, she would cancel this man's advertisements in that yellow pages for that whole year. And lo and behold, when she did what she did, when she billed it differently, an internal billing procedure for Southwestern Bell, that Bell admits under cross-examination that Mr. Delaney did not know about, Mr. Delaney had nothing to do with, that it had nothing to do with what he requested them to do. Lo and behold, it was deleted, his phone stopped ringing, and all of a sudden, he suffered damages far in excess of what, in fact, the ad cost. One of the things that Southwestern Bell has, and the position that it has taken before this court, and I find it quite disturbing, that it says that the distinctions that this court should make is that there is a breach and there is negligence. And let's assume that there is negligence. If there is breach and there is negligence, that the only time that a person can recover is there is injury to that person or injury to property. The problem with that logic is that there will be cases, and because of the technology in our society, this is not a state of hogs and pigs anymore. And we just don't sue because my hog was damaged and my horse was stolen or something of that nature. And that oftentimes in the business setting, one can lose their livelihood, their lifeline, and as Southwestern Bell in his advertising says, their business phone is their lifeline. And so all of this, when, if the court adopts such logic, then any business that is harmed in any type of case, not just this case, will never be able to recover reasonably anticipated damages consistent with Texas law. If one proves those damages up, you will never be able to recover lost profits. I think that is an unfair rule. That rule also, if the court adopts such a rule, ignores the Schoenbeck case. In Schoenbeck, what this court said is, and I think it's consistent with the jurisprudence throughout the country, is that even though parties oftentimes contract, there may be a tort involved in that. And I think the facts have been talked about, and that was they contracted for a hot water heater. Their home burnt down. If we were to extend that logic, assume with me if Southwestern Bell comes out and repairs a line, and the business person leaves the business and says, y'all take care of this small business man, and Southwestern Bell employees want to play a little prank. When one of their agents calls, they tell them, oh, cancel all the lines. Cancel all our advertisements with you. We don't want to ever do business with you again. Lo and behold, a year later, the book comes out, the ad is not in existence, the plaintiff somehow determines how this occurred, and he learns that Southwestern Bell employees, playing a joke, and we were just playing, told us to cancel the ad. Now, the problem with that is twofold. The first problem is Bell will come in and say, we have a limitation of liability, and I don't think that's before this court in this case because the court granted writ of error on the question of negligence. First they're going to come in and say, well, we have a limitation of liability. And then the second argument will be negligence. Well, even if it was negligence, even if you proved up a tort, there's still a problem. And they will cite the case of Delaney versus Southwestern Bell for the proposition that, oh, you can't receive damages for lost profits even though you proved them up. You showed no injury to the person. You showed no injury to the property, and therefore you can preclude it from getting relief. And we can postulate with those types of examples ad infinitum, and all of a sudden the state of jurisprudence in this state would be in disarray. I think Schoenbeck, I think I will submit to the court Jim Walters Home versus Reed, and all of those cases stand for basically the same proposition, that if you have a contract, and in that contract we look at the facts of a given case, and we determine what those facts are to make a determination whether in fact it is a contract or whether in fact it is a tort. That is what we pay judges for, to grapple with, to make a decision whether in this case, in these facts, whether we should apply a tort versus a contract.
What are the factors you look at to make that determination?
You look at the facts of the given case, and in Delaney's case, I think what we look at, we look at what was contracted for. They say go to the contract. Well,
we're talking about a duty here, and what does the duty stem from the contract or from somewhere else? What are the guidelines, the parameters?
I think Schoenbeck says that you have a duty to perform in a reasonable manner, and you have a duty to not be negligent in your performance. I think the court can very well reflect on Schoenbeck and the language in Schoenbeck to make a determination what that duty is. And I think that fluctuates with a given case.
But where does the duty stem from the contract?
It may very well derive from the contract, Your Honor. I'm not arguing that oftentimes the duty doesn't come from the contract.
But counsel, if it comes from the contract, haven't we already said that you lose? I think that's what we've said through all the cases, that if the negligence is related to the contract, you've got to prove up the contract before you can get to the negligence position. If that's where you have to go, then you lose.
That's not necessarily so in my case.
Well, in all the cases up to now, that's what the court is saying.
I don't think Schoenbeck stands for that proposition.
Well, assuming that it does.
Assuming that it does.
Assuming that what I say about it is right, and that is that you can't recover in negligence if you've got to prove up the contract first and rely on the contract out of which the negligence grew.
If I prove up a contract that I contracted with you orally to repair my hot water heater and you blow my house up.
That's right. That is negligence growing out of the performance of the contract.
And I don't think that's the status of the law. And I think that even if you, in this given case, one can say that the relationship of the parties was to contract with something totally different. I don't think the status of the law precludes Mr. Delaney from recovering under the theory of negligence.
Well, let's just assume that if the negligence grows out of the performance of the contract, you can't recover. And let's just take that as the rule. And you're wanting us to change that rule. There must be some public policy to change the rule. Now, what compelling public policy interest is there to cause us to want to change that rule?
It's the only game in town. It's what I said initially.
That the if there is a monopolistic situation, then we ought to apply a different standard for negligence going out of the breach of the contract.
The court could very well do that. I don't think the court has to go to that extent of saying that when one has a monopoly, then there will become a different standard. I think the court can very well address the issue of negligence versus a contractual issue and decide that Mr. Delaney's recovery in this case is proper. In this case, yes, there was an issue submitted to the jury on disparity of bargaining powers, and what the Court of Appeals did with that is the court said in the concurring opinion, we don't think that the whole issue of disparity becomes relevant because there was a negligence. There was a negligence cause of action, and the court did not need to submit disparity in the first place. And if we were to go forward with our logic with the legislature's recent amendment of DPTA, the whole question of disparity is put on the back of the monopolist. It's put on the back of the business who comes in and says, well, we don't think we were deceptive in nature. They now have that affirmative duty. So from a policy standpoint, I think that policy makes sense. But from a factual standpoint in this case, in Mr. Delaney's case, I think that the whole question of negligence, Mr. Delaney still recovers. And I agree with the Court of Appeals' concurring opinion in the sense that what the court says is, wait, what we're doing is no different than the law that exists in this state right now. What we're doing is looking at Schoenbeck and we're looking at Jim Walker's Holmes, and we're saying what Jim Walker's Holmes and what Justice Robinson said in that case was, we're concerned about the award of punitive damages and exemplary damages in this case. And I don't think Jim Walker's Home versus Reed changed the law in this state to all that great degree. There was a series of cases that they cite to the court that stands for the proposition that Jim Walker's Home had changed the law in the state. The first one was Rio Grande Land versus Light. But if you look at that case, it was a San Antonio Court of Appeals case, there was no finding from the jury with respect to a tort issue. So the court never had to get to that issue. The court never had to address it, and they addressed Jim Walker's Holmes and Dixon. Weber versus M.W. Kellogg, there was no finding of actionable fraud. The jury came back with a decision that the facts in that case, there was no finding of actionable fraud, and so the court never had to deal with the question of negligence versus a contract. And then in Allen versus Allen, which was out of the 14th Court of Appeal, there was no proof of fraud factually in that case. On the contrary, in Mr. Delaney's case, that jury listened to that evidence and that jury came back with a very simplistic answer. Yes, there was negligence. Yes, they failed to train. Yes, they failed to inform. Yes, they did not perform in a proper and prudent manner with respect to how they treated this. And I think that if you look at the facts in the various cases, and there was one of them, Heberson versus Nassau Development Company, Court of Appeals, Houston, 14th District, there was no proof of damages with respect, independent of the contract. And so in Heberson, all of a sudden the court said, let's look at the facts of this case. Let's make a determination as to what the damages were, and they submitted two to three issues on damages, and the court, in looking at the damage question, said, wait, the $38,391 that you were able to get from the jury on what you alleged to be a tort issue, and the $38,000 that you got from the jury for that was contemplated in the contract, it's the same thing.
Counsel, may I ask a question? Picking up on Justice Ray, assume that the contract was to repair the home, it was negligently performed, and the home blew up. Some of the commentators make a distinction of the type of damages suffered. In other words, to determine whether to award contract damages or tort damages based upon negligence, to decide which way to go, they say we should look at the type of damages that were suffered. If there are purely economic damages, they say we should go on a contract theory. But if there are, for instance, personal injuries, we should go on a tort theory, a negligence theory. And that's a distinction they've made. Can you respond to that?
If one, I think it's back to my initial point, that if one has an economic type of damage, I don't think that type of decision or that type of distinction should take place. And if one has a personal injury, I don't think that that type of distinction should take place and all of a sudden it becomes a tort because of it.
Well, now that's kind of the question I was asking you. Tell me why this court ought to make the rule the same so that if it's a personal injury, you recover damages, but if it's a loss of business, an economic loss, that the rule should be different.
Because it's consistent with what this court has said for a number of years, that if we can reasonably anticipate those damages, and if those damages somehow tie into the facts of the case, then one can recover for those.
Counsel,
and I'm sorry.
One of the commentators that I'm referring to is the United States Supreme Court, and that's the case I cited earlier, because that's the distinction they made. And I'm trying to reason through it just as Justice Ray.
Both sides looked at that case when the court cited it to the first party. I skimmed it. I was not familiar with the case at the time the court brought it up. But I think what that case said was it talked about the whole question of the parties can contract for what they want to contract for. They can make an agreement and they can be bound by it and they can limit their damages and things of that nature. I don't think that case is square on point with this case in a sense that even though parties can in theory, contract, and I can agree to sell you this product for X amount of dollars and we can have our consideration, I don't think that applies when there's a question of negligence. And I guess what my position is, and I'm trying to make it as clear as possible, is that when there is an issue of negligence, and if one can prove that negligence up, then one can very well recover for it. And I know what the court says, but if there's a contract for, and this is the agreement, why not limit it to that contract? Why not limit it one's recovery to that contract if in fact it's not a personal injury in question? And what my point becomes, if the court does that, it would obliviate the whole area of contract law as well as tort law, that a contract, even though a contract is not always a contract, that if someone negligently performs, and you can prove up negligence, that becomes the lawyer's responsibility. If you can come in there and say, my facts presented, and let's see what those facts are, I think that's when the court says, now we need to make that determination. Because, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I mean, it seems to me it's almost a racist case as far as the petitioner conceded that it would never happen in the end.
They only conceded through discovery. They didn't concede by calling Mr. Delaney on the phone and saying, this is what happened, Mr. Delaney. They didn't concede by all of a sudden saying, we'll confess judgment with you and we'll make you whole. I think, you know, that's what lawsuits are about. They conceded negligence through the discovery process, and when Mr. Delaney found out, in fact, what occurred, and if Mr. Delaney was not ever able to do that, then I think, yes, he probably would be limited to a contract is a contract and is always a contract. And that's what been my point since I've been up before the court, is that I think what Jim Walter says is you look at the facts of the given case, and you make a determination based on those facts. I think that's what Schoenbeck said. And I think that's the policy decision that Justice Ray brought up in terms of
If it's the only game in town, what is the consumer to do? And it's also the fact of this case is that Mr. Delaney didn't contract with them or didn't call them up to talk about his Yellow Pages. He had already had Yellow Pages advertising. He did not contract with them to make any changes in that advertisement. He called them up for the purpose of doing something with a totally different line.
This court does not want to hear every woman to put on the Yellow Pages.
And I don't think
that we've got the section of general rules that are applicable to this kind of case, but the entire field of people making an agreement with each other in demand, I think turned out an awful thing to put in the court. Now, that being the case, what public policy is it that would cause us to want to award economic damages for the negligent performance of the contract?
One of the things that the case, the Court of Appeals, the first Court of Appeals out of Houston, the Calarco case, talked about is that it talked about the disparity of bargaining power, and that we look at the facts of the case and make a determination as to, and that's one of the cases that we went off of in terms of preparing our trial, is that when the court said there is a monopoly, and we look at the marketplace, and we make a determination in that marketplace as to whether there's any alternative means, and this record is complete with evidence from various realtors, from various people in the community, that Southwestern Bell was the only game in town. If you were a realtor and you didn't have your ad in there, then God forbid it, you might as well close your doors now.
Well, if they're just one advertiser, then they have a very high standard, and if there are three advertisers, then they can be a little sloppier, and if there are 18 advertisers, you can just mess it up however you want.
Depends on the facts, but Calarco also goes a step up.
How can it depend on those facts?
But depends on the facts of the case. Calarco, in the Calarco case, the First Court of Appeals goes a step further. And this case was initially docketed in the First Court of Appeals and was transferred to the Sixth Court of Appeals by order of this court.
So you wrote your briefs with the First Court of Appeals in mind.
That's correct, before the Sixth Court of Appeals.
Okay.
But Calarco goes a step further. Calarco says, we also look at and make a determination of whether there was any real bargain for exchange or whether there was negotiable. And what Bell's testimony at trial was, they said it wasn't even negotiable. And the hypothetical was posed to the general manager, one of the general managers for Bell, to the effect that if I was a consumer, and I was a little bit wily with you, and I said, look, I'll give you three times the cost of ad, 10 times the cost of ad, if we can delete this language in the back of this, I just don't want it. He said, there's no way in the world we'll do it. If I gave you 100 times the cost, would you do it? It is not negotiable. And so the Calarco court says there are various policy decisions that the court must make in making those types of determinations. And that's how this case was tried. It was tried on a negligence theory, and it said, well, let's also look at the facts of this case and present the facts in this case consistent with Calarco to make a determination whether the disparity actually exists, to make a determination whether Bell was the only game in town, and yes, it was, and to make a determination as to how reasonable such a policy would be to say to a businessman, you can't recover your lost profits. The very argument that I make before this court is the very argument that a jury was submitted, and it's the very argument that the jury said, we think this makes sense.
But economic disparity alone is different from what you're arguing. And you're not saying economic disparity is in the media, and any time I make a contract with a corporation, a solvent corporation, that I get excused from the terms.
That's not necessarily so.
That surely can't be a test, but and you're always going to have one party going to be in a better position than the other, to some extent.
I understand the court's position, and I appreciate the court's position, but that's not necessarily so. I think the danger in trying to formulate an absolute rule
in any area of law it creates more problems than it solves. And when the court begins to try to say, absolutely, this is the posture, then this court also forecloses parties who have been hurt and who have been damaged from ever receiving the recovery. And I don't think the law has never been that unbending and unbending, and it is a living law, and it allows people to come forth, businesses as well as individuals, to come forth and say, I want you to look at my facts, and I want you to make a determination based on what my facts reveal in context of the law.
Now, would that same rule apply to the Exxon that is trying to get the ad in the Yellow Pages as compared to your client getting the ad in the Yellow Pages?
If Exxon's name wasn't in the Yellow Pages, Exxon's still going to do business. Exxon's still going to make money. And I think there's a substantial difference oftentimes when we look at the parties of the case, and I think that's where we talk about whether there's a disparity. If HL&T, Houston Lighting and Power, was left out of the Yellow Pages, I don't think it's going to affect HL&T too much, because if I want utility services, I got to go down to HL&T. They don't need to advertise.
Yeah, but Exxon might lose $3 billion, where your client maybe is only going to lose $1 million.
And in the marketplace itself, Exxon has added access, and without all the facts, Exxon has at its availability the ability of, they may spend $10 billion on advertising. And I'm pretty sure Exxon lawyers would do a wonderful job in presenting their case against Southwestern Bell Yellow Pages to seek to recover damages, and I'll leave that to Exxon's lawyers. But I'm not fearful that they won't get relief. Thank you.
May it please the court. I was hoping he would say that he would leave it to Southwestern Bell lawyers, but he didn't. I'd like to address just a couple of matters that were brought up by Ms. Griffin. First of all, the question was raised, Judge Wright, about what public policy factors could cause a situation where you want to change the law. And there was the question of monopolies. And I want to talk just a moment and address that just a moment, because I think there's one aspect of this that I have not addressed. I would reiterate, of course, that Southwestern Bell's Yellow Pages business is not a monopoly, certainly not regulated. And there has been no findings any time, any place, that there is a monopoly in that business.
I thought the testimony was undisputed that in 1980 in Galveston County, nobody else was selling a Yellow Page type format.
Well, I don't think that in of itself constitutes Southwestern Bell as a monopoly provider. I mean, there might only be one Chevrolet dealership there, or maybe one dealership selling Chevrolets there. Does that mean Chevrolet has a monopoly? I don't think so.
Well,
there are cars, but there's no other telephone directories.
Well, of course, in that particular instance, there were not. And in the instance of the Chevrolets, there were no other cars to be sold at. I mean, I think the analogy fits, but there's another point too, Your Honor, and that is that in determining whether you're a monopoly or not, you don't just look at the one product. You look at all of the related products that your product competes with. And it was our position at the trial level, and the court would not let us address the jury with this. Or presented instruction in that regard, but Southwestern Bell Yellow Pages Advertising is just another media for advertising. And if you talk to the advertising executives, they'll say that generally forms a part of most businesses' advertising budget, but it's by no means the only. There are other alternatives, and if there are other alternatives, forget that one may be a little better than the other, or one may be a little less than the other. If there are other alternatives, then I don't think you can say that that's either monopoly power or there's true disparity.
Yeah, but what you're going to tell me to do, If I'm one who advertises, I'm going to have to buy in all the, I'm going to have to buy in at least two advertising companies' books to make sure that I get coverage, because you might leave me out.
Well, and you might have to buy a newspaper advertising. You may have to send out letters to your customers, potential customers. There's a lot of things that you may have to do. But you see, when the parties enter that, contract, they know that that's what they're going to have to do. They agree to do it because Mr. Delaney at the time, I think you could argue, when his agreed that if the ad didn't appear for any reason, he would go somewhere else to get it. If it was so important, the risk was so important, he could get insurance, or he could just go to some other media and pay whatever he had to pay to get it. And it may be higher, it may be lower, but he's a reasonable, responsible businessman, and reasonable, responsible businessmen can get around problems caused by the loss of one type of advertising.
That is the non-negotiable term of the contract.
I'm sorry?
The portion of the contract you're talking about is non-negotiable as opposing counsel's suggestion.
The portion of the contract, the limitation of liability, and all of the terms and conditions are non-negotiable. In other words, we don't, as a matter of practice, X out that part of the contract if they ask us to. The policy is that we do not negotiate. Yes?
Is the Southwestern Dental sales literature about the lifeline and so forth, is that part of the record? Is it the business phone in your lifeline? Is there advertising from Southwestern Dental as part of the record you just said?
Well, there's advertising that says, let your fingers do the walking. And there it is. I would submit, though, that there is advertising about the benefits of television advertising, newspaper. They all advertise.
Is that in the record in this case? There is extensive literature available to Southwestern Bell telephone salesmen that people are not able to use that in the record in this case.
There is evidence in the record, in the form, I think, of testimony, that we have advertising that's let your fingers do the walking.
If your contract had said it's stipulated and agreed between the parties that if we leave this ad out, that the economic damages of the parties, the economic damage that the customer will suffer will be $2,000. If that would be
the consequence of that
we would review for reasonableness. Do you agree with that? I mean, any court would have the power to review that and see if that was a good faith anticipation by the parties at the time they entered into the contract of what the possible consequence of damages might be.
Not only would I agree with that, but I would also agree that if we had such a stipulation that your damages would be $2,000, that very issue would still be before this court as to whether it's reasonable. I mean, this court could make that determination.
Why is this different? Why is a clause that says you'll get your money back and that's all not a clause then that a court, regardless of, the tort contract dichotomy, and maybe it hadn't been preserved for us to look at it in this case, but why isn't this kind of clause the same kind of clause? I mean, because it is a liquidated damages clause. It's just whatever the amount of the error is that you're agreeing is the damages for the breach that will be obtained by the breach. Why isn't that the same kind of clause that a court can look at from a reasonableness standpoint and decide that this was not a good faith estimate by the parties of what the consequences of one party failing to perform the contract would be?
Well, maybe what I don't understand is that I don't know that it would make a difference whether it's termed liquidated damages or not. Whether it is or not, I think that this court can look at that contract anytime it sees fit. And courts like this court have done that all over the United States, look at it and look at the test for unconscionability and determine that the limitation is unconscionable.
Have you made a nationwide search because this is a nationwide business?
Your Honor, we have, in our briefing, we have set all that out, and there are very few. The great majority of the courts, I mean the great majority, has upheld the validity of that exact same limitation liability. The courts in this state have. There has never been a finding by any court in this state that it's unconscionable. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
It occurs to me that your company does a lot of advertising to businessmen that you ought to have yellow pages advertised. And it's enough that I think most good businessmen probably figure, well, gee, if I don't have a yellow page ad, I'm missing out on a lot of business. And I think it's to the point now where most businessmen are fairly well convinced. Now tell me what public policy would you espouse to keep the rule like I think it is right now, and that is you can't recover economic loss for breach of for negligence going out and breaching the contract. Why should we keep the rule the same when you've now convinced every businessman you ought to have your yellow pages, otherwise you're going to lose money?
Well, we certainly don't try to convince them that they have to have their yellow pages. We do the same thing any other
company
does.
Get off the
club. Well, Your Honor, we try to sell the product. I mean, I'm certainly not going to sit here and say that we don't advertise to sell the product. We do. That fact, I would submit, has been the case in every case that's ever looked at the issue, and they have not determined that fact in and of itself.
That's true, but you're doing more television advertising now than you used to.
Well, I don't know about that. We've had television for a long time. As far as I know, we've been advertising in television for a long time, as has most other media. And what has happened over the years is that there's more and more and more competition for yellow pages.
But businessmen now know that if they don't have a yellow page, they're not doing as much business as they ought to be doing. And the people in both of these cases seem to have that problem.
Well, they do have the problem, but they would have the same problem if they think that newspaper advertising is important. There's an important distinction here, Your Honor. In the first place, all other media, you can, if there's an error in let's say newspaper advertising, you can change it the next day.
Yes.
The public policy in favor of it is the fact that we can't do anything about it for a year. That's the public policy. That is the factor that makes it reasonable. That's one of those many factors that you look at if you want to determine whether it's unconscionable.
But because you can't change it but once a year, then that make you a lot more responsible for what you put in the book the first time. That is, make sure that everybody's ad gets in.
Well, I agree we have that responsibility, Your Honor. But human errors do occur, and they always have. And they're going to occur in any publisher of advertising. And as I indicated, I think if you try to put out the perfect book, it's just going to cost too much.
But because you make a few mistakes, shouldn't you have to pay for those losses that you do cause?
Well, Your Honor, I think the point is that there's a contract. And I get back to that. And if that contract, if there's a breach there, you have to look at the duties that were breached. I think the significant factor is, are you talking about duties that were breached in the contract? If you are, if the parties have agreed to this, and that's all part of it, and if you're suing on the basis of a breach of duties, doesn't matter whether it was negligence, doesn't matter whether it was intentional, the question is, what is the proper cause of action? And if what you're suing for is the benefit of the contract, if you're suing because of a breach of duties, and that's United Pressman, that's Jim Walker's home, if you're suing for a breach of those duties, then it's got to be under contract. And at that point, then you have to look at contract law. And I think that's the entire point.
Well, your idea is that the law as it presently stands is that there is no tort duty to pay economic losses that occur from breach of contract at the first time.
Well,
have to change that.
That's not my position. That's the position of the court. That's what the court has stated is the law of the state. And we're just saying that the duties here that were breached were duties under contract. Let's look at the contract. And let's not do away with contract law and just to close it out. When the court granted writs, I have three young boys, and they're 16, 14, and 11, and so I was bragging to them about, I was going to be at this court arguing the case, and so they asked me about it. They said, well, let me just kind of lay it out to them, see how they react to it. And I did. I tried to be fair to both parties, and I laid it out. My 11-year-old, and I explained it, that the court didn't.
You're on
our
time now, so hurry up.
At any rate, my son looked up, my 11-year-old looked up at me, and he said, well, Dad, if they're going to do that, they're not going to find a limitation. What's the use of having a contract? And I think that's the point.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll take a call. We'll take another brief recess.
John, please rise.